like to do is have everybody who works in a Department of Health, whether that's the federal, state, county, city level, stand up. Excellent. Now everybody who did work, still stay standing. Everybody who used to work for Department of Health, stand up. Great. What I'd like to do, I used to be one of those people too, is give everybody a round of applause. And the reason is because I think, you know, this is the American Public Health Association, right? And we, I think, all know, particularly those of us who have worked or are working in public health departments, what's been going on really the last three or four decades. And it's been slaughter in the public health department. There's been a couple of good blips in the sense of the HIV/AIDS crisis brought some good infrastructure into the health department. SARS did that, and actually, although originally it wasn't, some of the money that was originally designated to bioterrorism, that's now called emergency preparedness, has done some good work to reestablish some of the communicable disease investigation, some better communication among various hospitals, laboratories, et cetera. But what I want to ask you now, and you can raise your hand if you don't want to get up, is if the pandemic flu started today, if we got word from WHO that we're in phase six, and we'll talk about that a little later if there's time, where there was easy human-human transmission in cluster cases, who would be in charge of the United States? How many people think the military and Department of Homeland Security would be in charge? Raise your hand. Okay, great. That's a good way to start off. So, does this thing work with that? So here's our president. He's very concerned about avian flu like everything else, and this is a statement he made about a month after Katrina. And I think you'll see that Katrina is no coincidence in terms of what's happened, both before that, but particularly afterwards. The president at that time basically said, this is one of the options that we really have to take into consideration. You know, we messed up in New Orleans. We really didn't have it together. And then the 82nd Battalion came in and basically, in a way without doing it, declared martial law. Made sure that everybody was off the street as long as their skin was black and poor, made sure that the vigilantes were not taken care of and go ahead and shoot people, and make sure that services were not delivered to those people who most need it. Has anybody here ever watched Democracy Now! Or listened to it with Amy Goodman? There's a famous segment you can find on archives where Amy is interviewing Malik, who is the head of Common Ground, or at least was at that time, and Malik's standing right next to a dead body for 2 weeks. And Amy, being the way Amy is, goes out into the street, and every authority at every level, including the 82nd Battalion, pass by, and she stops them, and she says, could you please pick up this dead body? And there's a few more down the street, and nobody did it. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, what the critique of the 82nd Airborne was. Now, the birds are really not very happy about Bush wanting to bring in the military, because he knows, if you look at the bottom, what's going to happen to them. So none of them are sick anymore. Okay, so basically here's Dr. Erwin Redlener. I'm sure some of us know him and know that he's head of the National Center for Disaster Preparation at Columbia. This is what he said about Bush's statement. It's basically declaring martial law. And Bush has wanted to do this. He's made specific statements after Katrina. He's made specific statements about avian flu. Where basically he wants to have the authority to declare martial law without ever going to Congress. So what does all this, you know, have to do with Katrina, and what does all this come down to? Well, it comes down to something that was until a month ago called the National Response Plan. Now it's called the National Framework Initiative. They like to change names about every 3 to 6 months, but it doesn't really make any difference because the song and the words and the lyrics are still the same. This was developed after 9/11. It was in particular formally put online and distributed in April of 2005. And basically the important thing here in terms of what a lot of the brothers and sisters have been talking about in terms of Katrina is what actually was the turning point in terms of federal assistance in Katrina, and how does this relate to avian flu? Well, there was a specific designation within this plan about what that turning point is based on the tabletop exercises regarding Hurricane Pam that Hillel presented the first time. And that was, is there a little planner I like to work here? Okay. So in this document, now we haven't really ever gotten, the document was not developed yet in April 2005 to really deal with the question of pandemic flu yet. But William Arkin, who has a blog for the Washington Post, who does a lot of work on looking at the role of the military in the United States, you can just, you know, go to his blog, basically actually went through the entire NRP in October and basically found that there's 1,200 mentions of terrorism weapons and 45 about hurricanes and earthquakes. So what was the key issue? Was the key issue the fault of the mayor? Yeah, he was at fault for sure. Was the Governor Blanco at fault? Yeah, she was definitely at fault. But who was at fault primarily for why the federal response came almost a week later? Now, if you believe the news media, what it was is because Blanco didn't ask Bush. And this is based on something we'll get into in a minute called Posse Comitatus. But the real fact of the matter is it had nothing to do with Posse Comitatus, because Posse Comitatus, a federal law that was passed in 1878 to prevent federal troops from policing the country of the United States, basically has all kinds of loopholes. And any time the President of the United States wants to call in federal help for anything, he can, or she can do it without actually getting congressional approval. So that's a red herring that still exists in the minds of probably most people. What it really was is the fact that who was really in charge? Who was the point person for making this decision? And there was a point person. And this point person, and this is really, you can get, actually see the most important chapter of this book, which I'd really recommend, by Cooper and Block, who are now two reporters for the Wall Street Journal, called Disaster, Hurricane Katrina, and the Failure of Homeland Security. There's a person sitting in the Homeland Security Operations Center, which is still the point person. I'm sorry, the point place for any stuff we're talking about today. That's where the decision is made. It's not within FEMA. It's not an advisor to the president. It's this person who sits in that office who decides, literally and figuratively, when to pull the trigger or when to pull in the federal troops or whatever. Who was this person? Well, Marine Brigadier General Broderick. He was retired, and he basically said, and this was part of the plan that came out of the tabletop exercises, we're not going to call in federal troops, we're not going to call in federal anything until we're absolutely positive that the levees have been breached and not just topped over. So this is a really key issue. Now, while this was going on, probably a lot of you know about this, by coincidence, one of the most kind of like comprehensive vessels the Navy's ever built, called the USS Bataan, happened to be sitting 40 miles outside of New Orleans before the hurricane hit. And it rode out the hurricane and came within 5 miles. And it sat there for 1 week. Okay, one or two helicopters were used by the Coast Guard, actually, because the Coast Guard is the only part of the armed services that's outside of Posse Comitatus. In other words, they can move to provide federal aid without the president telling them to do so. So this is what the USS Bataan had, fully equipped. It could make 100,000 gallons of water a day, 6 operating rooms, 600 hospital beds. It sat there for a week without being used. Let's talk a little bit about PCA, Posse Comitatus Act. We talked about how the Coast Guard is excluded, and only the Congress is supposed to authorize any changes. The president by himself cannot do that. Did this stop George W.? You want to get the button here? That's okay. Go back. Not really. Basically what happened is, and this is not just a Republican thing, so let's not pick just on George W. He said within a week after Katrina, we're going to have to modify this act so that I can more easily call up, you know, the troops. Now, he knew very clearly that he could have done it before. So this was not something like, you know, I really don't know this, I don't know how to handle it, so let's just modify this act. No. He wanted to be able to take the terrorism that were rotting all over the world and be able to more easily apply it in the United States, along with all the constitutional things that have been done to strip us of constitutional and human rights in the last 7 years. Next. President Clinton did the same thing. Within 1 week after the Oklahoma City bombing, basically he said we'd need to modify the PCA so the military and civilian authorities could investigate WMDs. So it wasn't just Georgie who came up with that idea. Next. But that didn't stop George W., because George W., through John Warner, passed this act October 17, 2006. He signed it in a closed private ceremony. No press, no congressmen were allowed in the room except for John Warner. And here's what the act says. It allows the this is basically several senators' interpretations of this, and there's stuff online through the Washington University Law Journal that talks about this and other sources. It allows the president to declare a public emergency, station troops anywhere in America, and take control of state-based National Guard units without the consent of the governor. So I think we all know enough about our history to know that the difference between the National Guard, which is primarily civilians serving the National Guard, is that that was built in historically so that the governors had control over the National Guard. This would strip them of that, and it's in order to suppress public disorder. Next. Here's Section 333 that basically says he basically federalizes the National Guard. So it's not just the armed forces of the federal government. He federalizes the National Guard. Of course, we realize that one of the big issues that I think we're aware of is that over half the National Guard in Mississippi, Louisiana, and the surrounding states were in Iraq, and two-thirds to three-quarters of all their equipment, particularly heavy equipment, was in Iraq, which tremendously hindered the efforts in New Orleans and also the fires in California. This is a shot of New Orleans, and basically I think I talked a little bit about the role. I don't want to criticize everyone in the 82nd Battalion. They did some good things, but basically they did nothing to deal with the questions of race, poverty, and the distribution of services that we know too much about. Okay, who's in charge right now? It's basically November 5th, I think, about 2 o'clock. This is the person who's in charge. If there's a pandemic outbreak, it's the Vice Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard. This is clearly laid out in all the documents that Hillel put up there and anything you want to find, both the past National Response Plan and the present. Next. Okay, so the implementation of the plan, and this first came out kind of in public. People see Lori Garrett yesterday? Okay, Lori Garrett moderated a webcast, which unfortunately is no longer available online, on November 5th. I think it was about 2 years ago, actually, the Foreign Council on Foreign Relations in New York had a really important webcast, which brought together a lot of important people. In the second panel that had to do with the U.S. government's role, there's one physician who sits above all the other physicians in all four five branches of the armed service. And basically he made two statements that are kind of important to the topic today. Number one is DHS and the armed forces, Department of Homeland Security and Armed Forces, will be in charge of any pandemic flu outbreak. Aspects of it will be coordinated by DHHS and the CDC, but DHS and the military will clearly be in charge. Secondly is that at that point, 2 years ago, they had 2.5 million doses of Tamiflu. That means not just one dose each, but 2.5 doses of all the doses you would need, meaning that you'd have a 10-day rather than a 5-day supply, which is what people think may work, underlying the word may, already within the armed forces. At that point, there were about 100,000 doses that the CDC had their hands on. Next. Okay, now, what does all this mean in terms of how does it look today? Here's the GAO report from August 2007, available online. There are 6 different parts to the National Response Plan regarding pandemic flu. GAO said they addressed one of them. The problem definition and risk assessment, which I kind of disagree of how they address that, but let's just go with what the GAO says. It partially addresses 5 areas, and then the really important thing that relates to all of us who stood up is when it comes to resources, investment, and risk management, they don't even address it at all. Next. Now, do we have experience with this? How many people here have read John Barry's book on the Great Influenza? If you haven't read it, I'd really encourage you to put it on your book list. And some of the chapters are part of it's online, but we have experience with this. One of the fatal mistakes that the plan that Hillel presented by the U.S. government and the CDC, it's not clear, by the way, who's writing those plans, because in April 2005, the entire CDC website on pandemic flu was taken over by DHS. So when you go to pandemicflu.gov, that is a site controlled and basically used by DHS. It's no longer a CDC site for over 2.5 years. So it's not clear who made the plan up, but the plan, you know, is based on several fatal flaws. Number one is still today, as of 4 o'clock this morning when I looked it up, the plan assumes that easily transmittable cases, which is phase 6, where there are clusters and human-to-human transmission is going to take place outside the United States. Now, a lot of people still think the Spanish flu started in Spain. And those of you who have read the book and know better realize that not just by John Barry's account, but by most scientists, including people mentioned by our colleagues here, started in Kansas. This person, you know, happened to go into the armed services. World War I was going on. He went into the barracks. We know that, you know, in the first 1 to 2 days of being asymptomatic is when influenza transmission starts, not just when you become symptomatic. And the situation got worse with every step that the army commanders decided, the navy commanders decided to do against the advice not just of public health officials, but some of their own doctors within the armed services. Probably two of the most famous stories is that the virulence of this strain of pandemic flu, which has now been recreated, is potentiated when people are in close contact, and in close contact for long periods of time. Well, not only were tens of thousands of people being shipped across the ocean, Wilson refused to stop this because he'd already committed us to World War I. And a lot of those boats, half the people on the boat died before they got to the other side of the ocean. But before that happened, the largest military camp in the United States for training was outside Galena, Illinois. And at that point, an Army officer who was a physician was smart enough to realize the worst thing. People didn't know what influenza was then. He basically said the worst thing you can do is put these people in what are called confined barrack boxcars. 10,000 troops were loaded into one-mile train and shipped down to Georgia. Half of them were dead by the time they got there. But the strain became much more virulent at that particular time. Next. So we have experience about what the Army's role, you know, has been. Now, I think the crux of what I really want to talk about is why we, either passively or have not organized against, you know, what the Bush administration and neocons are doing, whether it's within health or within the destruction of our Constitution, the good parts of it. And I think this is the real reason. Hermann Göring stated it very clearly. You know, he said that basically people, if you bring fear to people, even if they're under a democracy, I mean, I didn't include the whole quote, but he talked about whether you're a democracy or you're a communist government, not just the fascist government, that basically, and you denounce people for being patriotic, that it works. And clearly in the last 7 years, with each succeeding day, it's working. Now, how has it worked in terms of us within this community where we're sitting and within the APHA? The APHA and many public health officials accepted the most absurd public health plan to come down the pike in decades, which was the smallpox vaccine scandal. Now, all of you who work in public health departments clearly know that you got directives from your directors saying you cannot carry out the basic public health functions, whether that's in primary health care or the basic public health functions in communicable disease control, water, sanitation, all the things that public health was built on, because money is going to be diverted for the smallpox campaign. I haven't found a good source to find out exactly how much money was diverted, but it's close to $1 billion. The estimates range between $900 million to $1 billion. And basically, this is the IOM report, the Institute of Medicine report, when the campaign was stopped. 38,000 people were vaccinated instead of 500,000, which was the original plan. Almost $1 billion was spent. And correctly stated, and this is the problem we've had for the last 35, 40 years in public health with those exceptions I talked about, where's the money going for disease surveillance and response plans? Next. Okay, so the moral of this is don't mourn, organize. The APHA actually has a decent position right now on pandemic flu. And the first thing is to understand where is the HHS and the CDC within this national response plan. They basically have one little part, section number 8, support function ESF number 8 says you provide traditional public health and medical services. You have authority over only traditional public health and medical issues which are outlined. In the February 2007 document, which you can find in the APHA website, I have to be very honest, being a member for over 30 years, I don't get excited about most things the APHA writes. I think they've done some good things, but this is a decent one to start with. And the first thing is that a pandemic flu is very different even than a hurricane or certainly a terrorist attack. And what they say is that it's public health experts that have to be in charge of this because these are incredibly difficult decisions, as Hillel mentioned. And I'm not going to go through all of them because Hillel already did, but these are tough decisions. Do you want, you know, the U.S. Army and Department of Homeland Security making these decisions, which is exactly what would happen if it started now? Or do we want all the different aspects of public health people who, of course, are going to have to bring in people, including the Army at certain points? But they're the ones who are going to be deciding this. So this is the statement from APHA, that DHHS should be in charge. I support that statement, except there's big problems, at least with the plan that Hillel mentioned. And I'm going to talk about a couple of them to end this. Go ahead. And the number one problem, of course, is what's happened to our workforce. This is from HRSA. This is updated every 3 to 5 years. And basically, we've had an absolute decrease of approximately 52,000 public health workers in the last 35 years. And we've had a relative decrease to the size of the population of about 40%. I think anybody who works or has worked knows, you know, that straight up every day when you go to work. If people are not familiar with the WHO pandemic website, I would really encourage you, particularly now that DHS controls our government's website, to really check that out on a regular basis. As people have mentioned here, we have no idea if H5N1 is going to be the thing or it's going to ever become human-to-human transmission easily, although there have been a few isolated cases. But we don't know that. And it may not happen now, it may not happen for 5 years, but it's going to happen. And so this is where the different phases that all the people in the world, including DHHS and CDC, have come to. There's six phases. We're in phase three. We've been there for the last couple of years. Beside the fatal flaw of thinking that this is going to happen outside the United States, there's an incredibly fatal flaw in the document itself about implementing the things that Hillel talked about. And basically it comes down to these three words: alert, standby, and activate. According to the CDC document that Hillel presented, the standby phase, this is the standby phase, is not going to happen, where basically you alert everybody. Now, do people know what BioSense is, the CDC BioSense? BioSense, by this time, actually 2 years ago, was supposed to have every hospital and laboratory hooked up into it. That's about, I think, 30,000 laboratories and hospitals. There's about 1,700 right now on BioSense. So we're really behind in this. But anyway, this is what it says. It says we're going to wait until phase six of the WHO epidemic, where efficient and sustained human-to-human transmission is before we even go into the alert phase. Then in standby phase, we're going to wait until there's widespread human outbreaks in multiple locations overseas. As far as I know, airplanes are still flying. You know, we didn't think that TB was transmissible inside an airplane until the first case happened 10 years ago, which is in MMWR. If you ever missed that MMWR, go back and look at it, because in a 7-hour flight, I think it was from Luxembourg to Minneapolis, active TB was transmitted to two people on that flight. So I think that's still there. And then the question of activation of the things that Hillel put up. Activation is only going to happen, according to the plan, when you've got laboratory-confirmed case clusters within your own city or state. I don't know how many of you ever dealt with epidemics or studied the issue of pandemics. That's too little, too late. These are serious issues in terms of it's not going to be easy to implement this, but it's not going to happen by waiting to that point. It's definitely too little, too late. The last thing I just want to emphasize is that I would really encourage people within your public health departments, if you belong to a labor union, you know, if you belong to an association like APHA, to get involved in this issue, because this is not primarily an issue of avian influenza. This is primarily an issue of two fundamental things. One is, what do we think democracy is in 2007, and do we value any parts of the Constitution of the United States that have been stripped away? And the second issue is, the answer to the public health part of this is to rebuild the infrastructure that's been stripped away over the last 30 to 35 years, and to really realize that when, in 1969, the Surgeon General of the United States declared, "The war is over. The war on germs is over. The war on public sanitation is over. We've done it all." Okay? So now we have the largest growing business in the United States is bottled water. There they are, right there. And the public health infrastructure and role in maintaining the water supply in this country is falling apart. The infrastructure of water pipes all over the United States are in terrible condition. And I could go on and on. So I think that's what I'd like to end it on, is that let's, you know, work together to make sure to not have any illusions about the Democratic Party when they get elected, if they get elected in 2008. There's not going to be a lot of changes in terms of what's happened so far, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy. If you listen and read everything that Hillary is saying and you don't believe me, just read what she says. Just read what her advisors say. So please don't have illusions about being saved by the Democratic Party, like we did last year in Boston when everybody's looking at the, you know, TV monitors in 2006 election and said, "Oh yeah, well, things are going to get better now." Well, I think we know what's happened. And the last thing is that have confidence in yourselves, in your families, in your friends, and talk about these issues and find other people to work with to make sure that we rebuild what we've lost. Thank you.